Hello and welcome to The Scoop, a provincial newscast and podcast with stories from LJI journalists around British Columbia. Each week, reporters from Revelstoke, Cortes Island, Kootenay, Terrace, Prince George, and Smithers will share the news affecting their place in BC. I'm your host and producer, Pamela Hassan, from CSCK News in Smithers. The Scoop was made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative Program, or LJI. Follow The Scoop on CICK, Smithers Community Radio, 93.9 FM, every Thursday and Saturday at noon, online at smithersradio.com, and of course, wherever you get your podcasts. The Kootenay Lake School District is expecting a decline in student enrollment for the 2024-2025 school year as more students are graduating than entering kindergarten. What does this mean for funding for District 8? Listen to CJLY's Scott Onyeshek's Scoop to find that out. Revelstoke RCMP are investigating a man who walked into Queen Victoria Hospital with a non-life-threatening gunshot. Melissa Jamieson at Stoke FM is on the scoop. Various Nishka Nation dancers are coming together for a massive opening ceremony event during the upcoming Junior All-Native Tournament. Sabrina Spencer has that scoop for CFNR in Terrace. The Cortes Island Academy is looking ahead to next year's programming for high school students with a focus on the interference between the arts and climate change. Lonnie Taylor for CKTZ on the Island has that story. Dan Messick continues the coverage of the Salisms Floating LNG project between Western LNG and the Nishka Nation government. That scoop is for CSEK News. But first, from CFER in Prince George, let's catch up with Ian Gregg. He's speaking with Imani Miller, owner and director of the Medicine Wheel Cafe in Prince George, as well as a drummer from the University Hospital of Northern British Columbia Traditional Drummers.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CFER Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. Joining us over the line today in the newsroom is Imani Miller.
I'm the owner and director of the Medicine Wheel Cafe, and I am one of many drummers for University Hospital of Northern British Columbia, UHNBC, Prince George Traditional Drummers.
On March 23rd, Saturday, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m., the drummers are meeting in the Northern Health Unit parking lot and inviting the community to join them to support our first responders for the fourth year anniversary. Imani, this is a significant moment and a milestone. It's been 4 years since Prince George, the province, Canada, and the world was in the throes of an international pandemic. Regardless of the variety of feelings about it, we could probably all agree that it was difficult and it was a mess. We could say that for sure.
It was a time of fear, wasn't it?
It certainly was. And it's important to embrace some of the positives that came out of that experience. And one of the positives is your organization coming together. Do you want to touch on just how UHNBC Drummers initially came together at the beginning?
Well, Les Mitchell, and there were a few others with him, but he's the one that organized it. And do you remember, I don't know if you remember, I read in the paper in The Citizen that some people were encouraging all of the neighbors in our neighborhood to go outside at, I think it was 6 p.m., and bang pots and pans, right? Just to let them know at the hospital, all our healthcare workers, that we were in support of them because they were absolutely jammed with patients and they were exhausted. And so the people wanted to let them know that we were behind them. So Wes got the idea, like, well, if we can do pots and pans, I've got a drum. I think I'll go to the hospital. And he did. He went to the parking lot with a few other people. And for 47 evenings in a row, they drummed for the hospital.
Incredible.
It was, yes.
One of the significant features of this is that a lot of people tend to think of drumming, a traditional drumming that is strictly exclusive to the Indigenous community, and outsiders aren't necessarily welcome in that ritual. But this activity is actually open to the entire community. And do you feel in this four-year anniversary that this has either intentionally or inadvertently bridged some cultural gaps in our community?
I hope so. It feels like it to us. If you look at our group, it's pretty diverse. Some of us are Indigenous, half Indigenous and non-Indigenous. And I guess our feeling is everyone's Indigenous to the planet. And so everyone, if you look at nations all over the planet, they all have their drums. The drum is important to all nations. And it's always been used in healing. And so I think Wiff came up with, you know, the idea of, because the drum is so healing, that's what he wanted to bring to the hospital and all the healthcare workers, but the staff that keeps up the hospital, like the ones who clean it, the ones who are security people, everyone, because they were all pulling together in there and they were working, you know, terribly long shifts and they were exhausted. And so the least we could do is stand outside the hospital in support of them and let them know that we were there. So yes, it's brought a lot of people together and we're open to the public. So if you come on Monday night at 6 p.m., whether you're Indigenous or not, you can get a drum. We have lots of extras and you can drum with us. And I don't know if you've ever been inside a drum group, but it's extremely inspiring. Just be in the middle of it and hear those drums and then the song. They're very inspiring and they're very healing, not just to the people in the hospital, but to us too.
If any of our audience wanted to join, do they have to be good at drumming to show up and participate?
No. I hadn't drummed for long time. I quit drumming when I was about 14. My brothers had made fun of me. And so, you know how you're at 14, I just put the drum down. Well, I never picked it back up until that when they started drumming at the hospital. And by that time, I was 70. And I thought, well, I've got a drum. I'd go up there and I'm not going to sing. I thought I had lost my voice and the strength of the drum song. And so I started drumming and Wes kept encouraging me, I can't hear you louder. And so he actually ended the whole project personally at a personal level, helped me find my voice again. So it's pretty inspiring. It's a good story and it brings people together that love this community and the people in the group love each other. Because in order to not just drum for the hospital, we drum for people who have lost a family member and they ask us to come to certain places and drum for them. They ask for prayers. They ask us to drum for all kinds of things. And so we go, we scramble and, you know, we get our gear out and we go whenever we can. And there's only one reason we do that, because we love our community.
To expand on that a little bit, you mentioned how you refound an element of yourself that maybe you forgot a long time ago, and you picked the drum up again into your 70s. And I've noticed at some of the events too, that there are some people who are so young, under 18, like maybe 12 to 14 time and time again. Yeah. And it's incredible to see the intergenerational experience that happens at these drumming events and how this organization has managed to pull in people from so many different walks of life in our community. And instead of identifying the differences that we have with each other and focusing on those and being pulled further apart, instead, this group has managed to come together and identify things we all have in common. People who want to support this initiative, who can they contact? How can they enable this to happen?
The best person to speak to would be Wesley Mitchell. You can get him on Facebook. We have our own email too.
And Wesley can be reached at 250-617-6648 or through email uhnbcdrumgroup@gmail.com.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or cfur.ca.
And now, here's an update from Dan Messick in Smithers for CSEK News on the floating pipeline, on the floating LNG pipeline project with the Nisga'a Nation called Salisms.
The Nisga Nation is going all in with its Xylisms LNG project, announcing last week, along with Texas-based partner Western LNG, that they will be purchasing the Prince Rupert Gas Transmission Pipeline from TC Energy to feed their proposed LNG facility. The PRGT received its EA permits a decade ago and is still active. However, it's due to expire in November. But if the current permit is granted a second extension, something the provincial NDP government has not committed to do so far, the pipeline could land in the hands of the Nisga Nation. The pipeline was originally approved for Petronas's defunct Pacific Northwest LNG project, but it could still come to fruition as the Nisga Nation moves forward with their plans for a floating LNG facility on Pierce Island near the Nass River and the community of Gingolk. However, this indigenous-led megaproject is not without opposition. Gary Reese, mayor of Lac aux Lambs, a Tsimshian nation on the north coast, and his council have been very vocal about their opposition to this project on account of the lack of consultation. As well, the Gitignau, an upriver nation whose territory encompasses parts of the Upper Nass and Kitwanga watersheds, are concerned and disappointed over the inadequate consultation and the rigid environmental review process. Although CICK News reached out to the Nisga Nation for comment about the move to acquire the PRGT and the growing concerns with the review process, they did not respond before this broadcast. However, in a statement about purchasing the PRGT from TC Energy, Nisga Nation President Eva Clayton said, quote, "In taking an equal ownership role in this pipeline, we are signaling a new era for Indigenous participation in the Canadian economy." Today, we'll speak with the mayor of Lac aux Lambs, Gary Reese, about his nation's concerns over the project. And we'll hear from Tara Marsden, WILP Sustainability Director for the Gitignau Hereditary Chiefs, about why the Gitignau are calling out the provincial government over what they see as a disregard for a thorough environmental review process.
My name's Gary Reese, and I'm the elected mayor of Lac aux Lambs.
Great, Gary. Thanks so much for being with us on CICK News. You and members of the Lac aux Lambs Council have been vocal about some concerns around the proposed Xylisms LNG project up in the Nass territory, driven by the Nisga Nation. Tell me about some of your concerns with this project as it is right now.
Well, it's in our territory. That's our concerns, and we don't agree with that project in our territory.
Where exactly, if you could just kind of describe where your territory is there at Lac aux Lambs and some of the other areas where this floating LNG plant is proposed?
It's all around up in, right by Pierce Island, goes right up to there, and in the Silver Gulf. It's all in our territory.
And was there any consultation done with Lac aux Lambs, either from the provincial government or from the Nisga Nation? Because it seems like it's going through the environmental assessment process right now, and I know there's a lot of questions that people are asking about this.
Yeah, we have our own people that work for us in our department, lands department, that have been asking for a lot of information on that area and the environmental studies and stuff.
And can you describe or tell me a little bit about the particulars of what in particular is Lac aux Lambs concerned about or posed with this project in particular?
It's in our territory, and we've never agreed to any projects being built in our territory without meeting with us and dealing with us on it.
What would be some of the requirements if they were to come to you with some consultation and some idea of what this might mean for Lac aux Lambs?
Well, we tried to get that and we couldn't get it.
Do you know why that is?
I have no idea.
This isn't the first time that you and Lac aux Lambs have dealt with an LNG project near or on your territory, within your territory. Pacific Northwest LNG at one point was proposed near the territory as well, and Lac aux Lambs has offered over $1 billion in compensation from the company. You know, how does this kind of situation match up with something like that? Are you and others in Lac aux Lambs opposed completely to this type of development?
No, we never said we were. In that first time around was on Lulu Island. There was the wrong place to pick to build in facility because of the flora bank there?
I guess at the moment, you know, as I mentioned, this is a project that's going through the environmental assessment. And we just heard recently that the Nishka are trying to purchase or acquire with their partner, their LNG partners, the Prince Rupert Gas Transmission Pipeline. That pipeline was originally meant for the Petronas project, Pacific Northwest LNG. You know, how do you feel about all of this?
Well, in the first place there, we should have been dealt with right up front there when it comes to our territory, and that didn't happen.
I guess what comes next? I know this is ongoing and obviously very active, but what are you hoping to engage with or see down the line?
Well, we're going to be dealing with that, and I won't say right now what will be happening, but when it comes to it, we'll take it from there.
Okay. Mayor Reese, I'll leave it there for now, but thanks for taking my questions.
No, you're welcome.
For that full story, as well as Dan's interview with Tara Marsden, the WILP Sustainability Director for the Gitignau Hereditary Chiefs, make sure to go to smithersradio.com.
This is a CKTZ News Update. I'm Lonnie Taylor. The Cortes Island Academy has completed their second year of a high school program for kids in grades 10 to 12. I caught up with the principal of the Cortes Island School, Michael Datura, to find out how the past semester has gone for this new school program and what is to be expected in the upcoming semester, the 2024-2025 CIA program. Michael shared with us how the new semester will be focused on the interface between art and climate change. CIA is taking registration for next year.
Yeah, so the registration is now officially open for CIA's next year. It's going to be an exciting year, I think. We're hoping to focus it on climate and art as to the interface between arts, the arts and climate change. Got some exciting speakers and presenters in the wings. We're hoping to maybe focus the showcase this year on art installations and experiences that convey the data of climate change in a meaningful and compelling way to the public. So the science course this year is going to be called Science for Citizens. The CIA already does a couple of citizen science projects on the island, but we're going to really hammer that home this year and hopefully get involved in some actual science on the ground. So looking forward to that.
Awesome. So you said registration just opened for next year, the 2024-2025.
Students can come from effectively anywhere. The age range, one difference this year is the program has traditionally been grade 9 to grade 12. And for various reasons, we're removing the grade 9 aspect of it. And then, for example, last year, we had a couple of students from Salt Spring Islands. We had students from Campbell River, students from the Comox Valley. And then we had two international students from Germany. So there's possibilities to come from anywhere. It's a cool opportunity to get folks to Cortes Island, too.
The Cortes Island Academy completed its second year now of its program. Is it officially no longer a pilot project? Is it now an established program within the district?
Yeah, I think we're on our way to becoming an established program. Definitely had two successful years. This year culminated in a showcase at the end of January that was very well attended by the Cortes community. It was a fantastic event. It allowed the students to showcase some of the major projects that they worked on this year. The main piece being short documentaries that they did with real youth on various elders and significant Cortesians, let's call them, around the island. And then they also showcased their podcasts, which they created in the CIA program. They had a poster project that I did with them called A People's History. This is inspired by a project that was started, I think, originally inspired by Howard Zinn, the American historian who wrote A People's History of the United States. And then there's an art collective in Portland, Oregon called Just Seeds. And they did this really aesthetically pleasing screen prints of these posters. So we had the students make their own posters focusing on significant local places and people. And then they presented those posters as well. And then they also did field books, field guides, which they did with Kai and Tosh in their science period, which also incorporated some Ijutham words
Is any of the poster work or any of those presentations on display anywhere?
Folks can witness and observe from that program is the new signage on the School to See trail. So they took their sessions with Jesse Louie and translated some of the plants and other features of the forest into iJuthum. And then with Christine Robinson, we went out and pounded in little cedar stakes all on the trail. So it's really pretty. And then all of the podcasts, they regularly get play, I think, on Cortez Radio, but they're also all available, the podcasts and the films, on the CIA website. Strongly encourage people to go check them out. The documentaries are amazing. And in addition to being made by local youth, which is cool, the people that they focus on are probably people's friends and neighbors from around these parts, and they're super interesting and profound, and they're nice and short too, so you can just watch them while you're doing the dishes or something.
You said that the showcase was really well attended. How many people do you think showed up?
It's right at the end of their semester. There'd be about 80 people there. It was quite the night.
You can find out more about the Cortez Island Academy, known as CIA, at cortezislandacademy.ca. Lonnie Taylor, CKTZ News, Cortez Island.
Editor's note, CFNR is a sponsor of the Junior All-Native Tournament. And WLON, I'm Sabrina Spencer with The Journey Continues, highlighting local stories that matter to you. The biggest basketball tournament in British Columbia is coming to Terrace, BC, hosted by the Nisga'a Nation. As plans for the event itself are being finalized, the Terrace Gitlachdak Nisga'a Society will be hosting the grand opening ceremonies. CFNR spoke with Lyle Adams about the preparations that are underway. This year, one of the biggest things is happening here in Terrace during spring break, which is the Junior All-Native Tournament. The Nisga'a Society will be performing during the opening ceremonies.
Yeah, the Gitlumga Nisga'a Dancers, yes, we will be.
I've noticed that your dance group there performs quite a bit. So is this something that you're ready for? You've been, like, what type of preparation have you done for this opening ceremonies?
Well, we're just working on our program that we're going to sing during the celebration when the teams all come in. But we're also working with other Nisga'a dance groups that are from our nation that will be coming to participate with us, as we'll have some singers and drummers from Gitlachdamik, Gitwintif, Lakhaldap, and Gitkinzo. They'll all be participating, so we'll be working together as one nation, but we'll be leading all the groups together. But yeah, so that's what's going to be happening this year, and we're looking forward to this. We're preparing various songs that we're going to do as all the athletes come into the building. So we're working together with the people that are organizing the whole event.
So for your group here, based here in Terrace, how many dancers do you have for that group?
Well, we average between 40 and 60, or even more. But we're starting to grow again, so it's a lot of fun. We work together on a weekly basis, practicing or getting ready for various events that happen throughout the year.
For the opening ceremonies, you mentioned the various groups from the Nisga'a Nation are coming together. So do you know about how many you'll have for opening ceremonies?
Well, we're told we're going to have at least 75 for that date. But we're still working and communicating with the organization on how everything's going to look for that date.
Is there anything else you'd like to share with us at all?
Oh, well, we're looking forward to this honor of being able to do this for the Junior All-Native Tournament. We are really excited and looking forward to that day and what program we're going to have for the celebration when the teams come in. And we're looking forward to being able to share our songs of our Michigan Nation with all those that are coming to this celebration of this wonderful tournament that happens every year for our young athletes.
This story is brought to you in partnership with the Local Journalism Initiative of Canada. You can see the full story at frequencynews.ca.
Revelstoke RCMP are investigating after a man with a gunshot wound was left at Queen Victoria Hospital this past Thursday. Revelstoke RCMP say they were made aware of an injured man who walked into Queen Victoria Hospital at around 6 a.m. on March 14th. The victim, who is well known to police, was treated for non-life-threatening injuries. The Revelstoke RCMP General Investigation Section is working to determine what happened. In a media statement, RCMP say a possible scene has been identified, but has not yet been confirmed. BC RCMP spokesperson James Grandy said the investigation is in its early stages, but it is believed to be an isolated incident with no threat to the public at this time. Anyone with information about the shooting is asked to contact the Revelstoke RCMP at 250-837-5255 or anonymously by calling Crime Stoppers at 1-800-222-8477. For 92.5 Stoke FM in Revelstoke, I'm Melissa Jamieson.
Enrollment projections for the 2024-2025 school year were released at the School District 8 board meeting yesterday. Enrollment projections are submitted to the Ministry of Education and Childcare no later than February 15th each year. For the 24-25 school year, the district is projecting 4,411 regular K-12, 16 alternate, and 275 online learning students. This is an estimated decline of 70 students. School District 8 Secretary Treasurer Kathy MacArthur presented these statistics to the board and explained the impact they'll have on funding.
At current 23-24 per student FTE rates, this would result in an approximate total funding reduction under the operating grant of about $603,000. The $603,000 is actually composed of two reductions and one addition. So the reduction is a reduction in the basic enrollment funding of approximately $600,000, and that's due to the lower enrollment, and then a reduction in the supplement for unique student needs of about $110,000. And these two items, which total $720,000, are offset by an increase in a supplement for enrollment declines.
This decline in students is expected to continue for the next several years, as School District 8 is seeing more students graduate than entering kindergarten. As mentioned, the projected reduction of over $600,000 in funding is based on the 23-24 per student full-time equivalency or FTE rates. On Friday, March 15th, the ministry will release the preliminary per student enrollment-based funding calculations for 24-25. Secretary Treasurer MacArthur also noted that these are simply projections and will change in the coming months.
And the other thing to remember with any of these enrollment projections, they're just the enrollment projections that we had when we submitted to the ministry on February 15th. So as time goes by over the next 3 or 4 months and then throughout the summer, our actual enrollments will change. So this is just a preliminary look at it, which will form part of the budget work that we do in April and May.
Reporting in Nelson, Scott Onstruck, KCR News.
And that's this week's episode of The Scoop, a podcast and broadcast featuring stories from remote BC by the journalists in the communities of Smithers, Cortez Island, Revelstoke, Kootenay, Prince George, and Terrace. This program was made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative Program. Tune in next week for another episode and follow us online wherever you get your podcasts.